The following sermon is from the works of Reverend Andrew Gray, 1633-1656. Andrew Gray was a renowned 17th century Scots divine steeped in Reformed and Puritan theology, converted and called to the ministry in his youth. Gray was blessed with remarkable proficiency both in learning and divinity. At the age of 19, he was ordained in the High Kirk in Glasgow. Gray's popularity as a preacher was nearly unparalleled in his day. He rendered doctrine intelligible and practical. He aimed for the conscience. He spoke to the heart in comforting the newly reborn, in arresting the backslider, and in unmasking the hypocrite. All his preaching honed in on winning souls to Jesus Christ. This sermon is called Arguments and Directions for Hearing the Voice of God's Threatening Rod. Micah 6 verse 9. The Lord's voice crying unto the city, and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it? It is a question that is hard to determine. Whether the greatness of God or the condescendency of God be the greatest mystery. But oh, when both these are put together, they make up a matchless mystery. What is more dreadful than power which cannot be resisted? And what is more terrible than wisdom from which nothing can be hid? And yet what is more sweet than the love wherewith he has loved us and the unchangeableness thereof, which does cut off all suspicion? I would only say this unto you. God has been speaking to you divers ways and by different things as the apostle speaks. There are many voices in the world, and every voice has its own signification. So I may say, there is not a voice by which God speaks to you that needs to be a barbarian speaking in an unknown tongue. I confess, it is sad, that when God condescends to speak unto us so many different ways, there should be so many who should stop their ears. Are there not some to whom Christ hath piped, and they have not danced? And now he is beginning to mourn to you, and oh, will you not lament? I would say this unto you, the day may be approaching when Glasgow's rods shall be preachers, and its crosses teachers from the Lord. Yea, God is beginning to preach that word to you that is in Jeremiah 2, verse 31. O generation, see the word of the Lord, and so on. If he will not hearken to God in the voice and mouth of his preachers, he will send a more severe preacher unto you, and you shall be forced to hear his voice. I say, look that the contempt of Christ in his rods, in his ordinances, and in his offers, make not this place an Alkadama, a place of blood, and a Golgotha, the place of dead men's skulls. I say to you, the day may be approaching when you shall meet with these six silent things from God. First, when you shall meet with silent rods, when you shall not know nor understand the language of them, when they shall speak to you in a strange and profound language which you shall not understand. Secondly, when you shall meet with a silent God, when you shall cry to him and he shall not hear you. Thirdly, when you shall meet with silent and dumb ordinances which shall not speak unto you. Fourthly, when you shall meet with silent mercy, so that all the good things he doth unto you, you shall not know their language. Fifthly, when you shall meet with the sad lot of a silent conscience, when you shall not be reproved by it when you sin, but God shall give you leave to fall and depart and not to return. And lastly, when you shall meet with silent commands, with silent threatenings, and with silent promises. That is, you shall never know what the promises call, for what the threatenings call for, nor what the commands call for, when he shall chastise you in the dark, and there shall be none to deliver you, and when there shall be none to plead your cause, but a sin-revenging God entering the list with you. When he shall say to them that are left, do not pray for this people, nor intercede for them, for they are the people upon whom I will have no mercy. I may say, by all appearance, our judgment will speak this, He has spoken unto us in the still small voice of the gospel, and he has spoken unto us in the whirlwind, and yet he is in none of them. But what know ye, but God may the next time speak to you, closing himself in a circle of fire. I have sometimes spoken that word to you, awake, awake, O sleepers, and call upon your God. But to come to the words in this chapter, the prophet has been leading a sad process against his people for the neglect of duties which were lying at the door. And now we have in this verse the conclusion of it. The scope whereof is this, showing the people that the Lord would send a more sharp message if they will not obey. And in it there are four things considerable. First, we have an excellent exhortation given to hear the rod, and by it is not only meant to take up what the rod speaks, but also who hath appointed it. Secondly, there is that excellent consideration to press men unto it. It is the Lord's voice. We may say that of the rod which was said of Herod in another sense. It is the voice of God and not of man. Thirdly, we have the people to whom the exhortation is given, and it is unto the city, that is, to Samaria, and to the bordering towns thereabout. Now the reason why the Lord's voice cries to the city rather than to the country is either this. The city ordinarily has most eminent tokens of the mercies and respects of God, which being abused, make God especially to contend with them. Or else because of this, ordinarily most profanity is broached within the city, and doth vent itself thence into the country, according to that word which is spoken of Jerusalem, that from it profanity goes out to the country, or whole land. The fourth thing in the words is, the persons that will hear the voice of the rod, the Lord's voice, and it is, the man of wisdom shall see thy name, or as the word may be rendered, the man of substance, or of substantial wisdom, which speaks that it is one of the greatest follies that is imaginable not to hear the voice of the Lord in his threatening rod. The last thing in the words is the way how the man of wisdom wins to the right use-making and understanding of the voice of the rod, and that is by seeing his name. Now, by the name of God may be either understood the seeing of the authority of God in his threatenings, or by the name of God may be understood his wisdom, his peace, his power, his justice, his sovereignty, and his holiness. The man of wisdom shall see these five excellent attributes of God shining in the rod, and in every sad dispensation which he meets with. And the reason of using that expression, he shall see, is to point out those certain and distinct discoveries which the man of wisdom shall have by such a cross. Now, having thus made plain the words to you, there are three things which we shall speak a little to from the scope, before we come to the first thing in the words. The first thing which we shall take notice of from the scope is this, that the slighting of known duties is a forerunner of some sad and lamentable stroke from the Lord upon a person or people. Though things which they know to be duties, and yet slight and disobey, are the forerunners of some sad and imminent act of the displeasure of God to a person or people. This is clear in Luke 12:47. That servant which knows his Lord's will and prepares not himself, neither does according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes. And that word in Jeremiah 5:5, I will get me to the great men, and I will speak unto them, for they have known the way of the Lord and the judgments of their God, and so on. Yet it is said of these, they have altogether broken the yoke and burst the bonds. And what follows, verse 6, wherefore a lion out of the forest shall slay them. Romans 1, where they professed themselves to know, yet they glorify him not as God. Verses 21 and 26. This is given as a reason that he gave them up to a reprobate mind to do things not convenient. It is probable the impiety and profanity of the people is come to a wonderful height, when they can sin against light and knowledge. Now, in speaking to this more fully, I shall speak to some aggravations of the sin of slighting known duties. The first aggravation is, when a person slights duty after the sinfulness of that sin has been discovered to him and engraven on his conscience, oh, that is a mighty aggravation of that sin. This is clear, Hosea 5:2. And the revolters are profound to make slaughter, though I have been a rebuker of them all. Nehemiah 9:29. And have testified against them, yet they dealt proudly and hearkened not to thy commandments, but sin against thy judgments. I confess sinning is against convictions of conscience, especially when they are sharp, is a greater sin than a sin against light. This is indeed to sin with a lifted up hand, and not to blush, nor be ashamed, nor yet to be afraid to commit iniquity. Know now, therefore, that there are many here that slight known duties, notwithstanding of light, and the convictions of conscience, which they have had for doing so. I would only say to that person, be afraid and stand in awe, lest the day be approaching when God shall cease to be a reprover unto you, and the rein shall be laid on your own neck, and you shall be as a wild ass snuffing up the wind. The second aggravation of slighting known duties is, when a person slights known duties after God has been discovering discontent with another person for that sin, when we see the justice of God overtaking another person for slighting of a known duty, and yet the person which stands beside is not afraid to persist in the same sin. This is clear in Jeremiah 3, verse 8. And I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. As if he had said, though Judah has beheld what I have done to Israel for her whorish carriage, yet notwithstanding of this, she went and played the harlot also. I confess this is a greater aggravation than the former, and it speaks that such a sinner and a manner has given a defiance to the justice of God, and has cried out in a manner, I care not what God will do, I will take my pleasure. The third aggravation of the sin of slighting known duties is, when the person slights known duties after God has begun to contend with them for so doing. This is a mighty aggravation of sin, as is clear in Isaiah 57:17. For the iniquity of his covetousness was I wroth, and smote him. I hid me, and was wroth, and he went on frowardly in the way of his heart. A froward sinner has had the rod shaken over his head, and has drunk something of the justice of God for slighting such a duty. Yet to persist in it, oh, that is a scarlet and mighty transgression. And yet are there not many here who are such? The fourth aggravation of the sin of slighting known duties is, when a person slights known duties upon very small temptations, is not this certain, a word of temptation, the half of a word, yea, the very knot of a temptation will put us from the doing of known duties? Yea, sometimes we will be glad of a temptation to divert us from the exercise of duties. Yea, sometimes it is known when temptations are not present to divert us from the exercise of known duties. We will go forth and seek a temptation. I confess the devil needs not to be at much pains in these days. There are many who give the devil work and employment. Yea, and if he seek not them, they will seek him. The fifth aggravation of the sin of slighting known duties is, when persons do not so much as set about the well-doing of them, that is a great aggravation. This is clear in Luke 12:47. He that knoweth his master's will and doth it not, and neither doth prepare himself to do it, is worthy of double stripes. He will not take pains to prepare his heart for duties, and that is a mighty aggravation. Some are content to be under their fetters as though they were bound of God. Some are content to live under their convictions as though it were impossible for them to answer them, and they say there is no hope. The sixth aggravation of the sin of slighting known duties is, when a person slights known duties after God has commended the beauty and excellency of such duties, that is no doubt a great aggravation, as when God does commend prayer and discovers the beauty thereof to a Christian. Oh, then it is a sad and lamentable thing for that person to sit down and slight his duty. That is, as it were, to slight prayer when it has on all its ornaments. The seventh aggravation of the sin of slighting known duties is, when persons slight duties after they have been convinced of the advantage which waits upon the doing of them. And there are some that slight prayer, notwithstanding they have been convinced that prayer has been to them a Mount Tabor, in which they have seen Christ transfigured. Some will slight prayer after they have been convinced that prayer has been a trysting place betwixt Christ and them, and after they have been convinced that prayer has been as the top of Mount Pisgah, on which they have gotten a view of the promised land. Oh, that is a notable aggravation of the slighting of known duties, when the person has this to say, "Now I am slighting my own advantages." There is this last aggravation, when a person slights known duties, yet with very little resentment and grief of heart. Are there not many persons that have slighted their morning prayers here today and yet have not convictions of it? And are there not many persons here today that oftentimes go to bed without saying their prayers and yet have as much peace of conscience as if they had done it? I think a person has gone a great length in hardness of heart when he can slight known duties and yet not be grieved. Yea, it is a token that he has not only to do with a hardened conscience, but with a hardened will. Are there not many persons that, notwithstanding of the slighting of known duties, yet never had a broken heart? Therefore, does not the misbeliever slight the commandment of faith and yet not weep for it? Does not the secure Christian slight the commandment of prayer and yet not be grieved therefore? Does not the presumptuous sinner slight self-examination and yet is not much grieved? And does not the dissolute sinner that is under the power of his idol slight the commandment of mortification and yet not have a sore heart for it? Now the second thing to which I shall speak from the scope is, I shall propose some considerations to press you to the exercise of all known duties. The first consideration is, it is the Christian who practices and not the Christian who knows to whom the promises are made. Would you know the Christian who has a right to the promises? It is not the Christian who knoweth his duty, but it is the Christian who doeth his duty. This is clear in Matthew 7:21. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doth the will of my Father which is in heaven. I think if the promises had been annexed to the knowledge of duties, then doubtless Balaam had been in heaven. It is not the knowing Christian, but it is the practicing Christian to whom the promises are made. The second consideration to press you to the exercise of known duties is, it is the Christian that is taken up in practicing and not the knowing Christian that is blessed. Would you know the blessed Christian? It is not he that knows his duty only, but it is he who knows his duty and doth it. According to that word, John 13:17, if ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. Where you may see happiness as the next to doing and not to knowing. I confess, if you can speak your duty like an angel, and if you know the smallest command in Scripture to be a command lying at your door, yet if you do it not, you shall never be blessed. Oh, know it. There are many knowing persons in hell today. The third consideration to press you to practice is, it is a practicing Christian, and not the knowing Christian, that is a proven and commended of God. This is clear in Song of Solomon 7:1. How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O princess, daughter, and so on. Christ takes first notice of the bride's feet, which is her practice, and commends her for that. Believe it, Christ commends a Christian's feet more than his eyes. That is his practice more than his knowledge. It is a practicing Christian who shall have that word spoken to him in the day of the Lord, "Well done, good and faithful servant." For if you knew never so much, and yet do not practice it, Christ shall never commend you. The fourth consideration to press you to the doing of known duties is, it is not the knowledge, but the practice of duties which will give peace to a Christian's conscience. If you would know all the commandments in the Bible, and yet never do one of them, it is nothing. It is not your knowledge that will give your conscience peace. I say this to you concerning many, their knowing and their slighting of duty will one day make their conscience roar like a lion, while they have nothing to answer it. I say unto you, O Christians, if you would have peace of conscience in the great and terrible day of the Lord, then practice what you know and desire to know what you ought to practice. The fifth consideration is, it is by the practice of your duty and not the knowledge of your duty that you rise up in conformity with God. It is the practicing of what you know and not the knowledge of what you should do that raises you up in conformity with Him. If you knew all that you should do and do it not, you may be strangers to God in respect to conformity with Him, as if you were merely ignorant. I wish there were in these days less knowledge and more practice, or rather I wish there were more knowledge and practice both together. I think the Christians of this time sin against a witness in heaven and a witness in their own conscience. I think there are some, but few amongst us, in these days that sin out of ignorance. But I would say this, the person that sins out of knowledge condemns himself, but the person that sins out of ignorance, the law condemns him. There is this thirdly that I would say to you from the scope, I would have you observing these six things concerning known duties. First, many persons are more desirous to know what they should do than to do what they know. Some persons cry out, wherewith shall I come before the Lord? And the Lord may answer them with this, have not I showed thee, O man? There is a second thing which I would have you knowing, the question which shall be proposed to you in the great and notable day of the Lord shall not be, O man, what knewest thou? But it shall be, O man, what didst thou? This shall be the question which Christ shall put home to you in that day. What didst thou in thy lifetime, and not what knewest thou in thy lifetime? Thirdly, I would say this, believe it, a grain weight of sincerity and practice is worth a talent of knowledge. It is better to practice as the weakest Christian than to know as the most excellent angel, not practicing what we know. Christ weighs not our graces by quantity, but by quality, not by degrees, but by the truth and reality of them. I say, if thou knew never so much, a grain weight of sincerity and practice in God's sight is more worth than it all. If you were as eloquent as Apollos, and as wise as Solomon, and can speak with as many tongues as Paul, and if you knew and understood all mysteries, yet if you do not practice your duties, it is all to no purpose. Fourthly, I would say this, the slighting of known duties has many sad disadvantages weighted upon it. And I shall name these four unto you. First, the slighting of duties makes Christians weary in duties. Is there any person here that slights duties at such and such a time? I prophesy this to you. You shall weary of duties ere long. This is clear. Isaiah 43:22. But thou hast not called upon me, O Jacob, but thou hast been weary of me, O Israel. I say slighting of duties and wearying in duties will not be long asunder. Secondly, slighting of known duties brings on much hardness and stupidity of heart, according to that word in Nehemiah 9:16, where disobedience and hardness of heart are knit together. Would you know the reason why so many persons are under so much deadness and under so many bonds? It is because they slight known duties. Thirdly, the slighting of known duties doth see three things to our conscience. It either mars a peace of conscience, or else it hardens a conscience, or it lulls a conscience asleep. I wonder how any of us can call ourselves tender, since there is so much slighting of that we ought to do. Are there not many Christians which may soon tell all their private prayers that they make to God? There is a fourth disadvantage which weighs on the slighting of known duties, and it is this. A Christian who slights duty sometimes is exceeding formal in that duty which he does. There are some Christians who slight prayer one day and the second day, and it is 1 to 100 the third day. When that person prays, it is but mere formality. Oh, what makes Christians pray so weakly? It is because they teach their hearts the art of praying formally by slighting of duty. Fifthly, I would say to you, the slighting of known duty is the first step of the sin against the Holy Ghost. This is clear in Hebrews 10:26. For if we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remaineth no more sacrifice for sin. I will tell you what is betwixt the sin of slighting known duties and the sin against the Holy Ghost. There is no more betwixt them both but that word willfulness. And what knowest thou but thy slighting of duties may come to willfulness ere long? You should know this, that under the law there were sacrifices for sins of ignorance, and likewise for sins of infirmities, but there was no sacrifice for presumptuous sins. Now if this be the first step toward a sin against the Holy Ghost, I am sure there are some here who have gone this length. Yea, and I fear a little further. Now will you take home this conviction, and I will say this, let the person who is not guilty of this offense amongst us take up the first stone and cast at us. I suppose our conscience might accuse us that we might steal out one by one. Oh, the dreadful disadvantages which attend that person that slights known duties. This is a strange thing. Our consciences are no more moved at what one can speak of that which is our sin indeed, than though it did not concern us. I suppose there is no one here but who may write this on his forehead. Guilty. Guilty. Now if there is this lastly, which I would say unto you, the day is coming when the slighters of known duty shall be forced to cry out, oh, that I had been an idiot and had never known my duty. I confess the slighting of known duties and the sinning against light shall be a mighty aggravation of our sin. Oh, what terror was it to Judas's conscience when he came to think of this? I have sold my master and I know I have sinned in so doing. And oh, what terror likewise will it be to you when you shall be convinced of this? My conscience told me that this was my duty and I would not do it. Now the next thing which we shall speak to from the words in general is that God, in the depth of his condescendency, has many various ways of making known duties to a person or people. This is clear from the words where God, having pressed duties upon his people by the voice of his ministers, next sends a more sad and terrible preacher to them, even a threatening rod. Now this is clear that God has many ways in pressing people to their duties, Isaiah 5:4. What could have been done more to my vineyard than I have not done to it, and so on. This is also eminently clear in Psalm 5:2. Open to me, my sister, my spouse. And if that will not rouse, he will knock at the door and say, it is the voice of my beloved that knocketh. And if that will not do it, he will use arguments to persuade her. Open to me, my sister. Is not that an argument? Yea, he will give her another, for my head is filled with dew and my hair with the drops of the night. And if all these will not do, Christ will put in his hand at the hole of the door which speaks this, that Christ in the depths of his condescendency leaves nothing unsaid to press people to their duty. This is also clear in Deuteronomy 11:26, where he sets life and death, blessings and cursings before them to press them to their duty. I confess there are many in heaven today that Christ never took the half of the pains on them as he has taken on some of us. And there are many in hell today upon whom Christ took never half so much pains as he does on some of us. And is it not then a wonder that we are not sent away to hell likewise? Now I will tell you 6 great voices or means wherewith God presseth his people to their duty. The first voice is a voice of threatenings. And of all the threatenings which are in the scriptures, this is a voice, O, give obedience to your duty. This is remarkably clear from that choice in a remarkable place, Jeremiah 36:3-7. Therefore go thou and read the roll which thou hast written from my mouth, and so on. Baruch is commanded to read all the threatenings of God to his people, and what is the precious end he has before him. And may be they will present their supplications before the Lord, and will return every one from his evil way, and so on. This is the very end and scope of God's threatenings, that persons may present their prayers before him, and he will shake the rod over their heads for this end. Therefore I say, give the threatenings of God, which are his messengers, that which they require, and it is to put the rod by the door. The second great voice whereby God sometimes presses home duties upon folk is by the voice and rod of those sad afflicting dispensations which we meet with. This is indeed the end of them, that persons would give obedience to this command of God. This is clear in the very scope where he presses them to hear the voice of the rod, that they may give obedience to their duty. And it is also clear from that sweet and excellent promise, Ezekiel 20:37, "And I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant." I say the very great end and design of God in sending rods is that persons may be engaged to their duty. The third voice wherewith God presses people to their duty is by the voice of the promises. What is the great voice of the covenant of promises? It is give obedience to the commanded duties. This is clear in Ezekiel 11:19-20. "And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within them, and I will take the stony heart out of their flesh, and I will give them an heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes, and keep mine ordinances, and do them," and so on. As it were, all the great promises of the covenant have this promise, "Obey and you shall live." It is obedience that leads us to the possession of the promises. The fourth voice in which God presses people to the doing of known duties is by the voice of all the mercies which we meet with. I say the voice of them all is this, "O give obedience to his commandments." Yea, this is the very language of mercies. All the great things which God has done to you, what is the scope and end of them all? It is, "O, will you come and obey?" Fifthly, does not the great voice of our consciences and of all the convictions which God fastens upon them say, "O, give obedience and obey with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." There is this last voice whereby God presses people to the doing of known duties, namely by the voice of the public ordinances. What is the great voice of all those preachings which we daily preach to you but this, "O, give obedience to the commands"? Now I would say this unto you, O people of Glasgow, O, has not God spoken unto you by mercies? Has he not spoken unto you by threatenings, by the voice of the promises, by the voice of the rod, by the voice of our consciences, and by the voice of public ordinances? Oh, look that in the 26th chapter of Leviticus be not Glasgow's plagues. Lord, keep this place from gospel condemnation, for it is a fearful and dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Yet seven times more, I fear, be your plague. Oh, what can God do more to us than he has done? Have we not pressed this duty upon you that you would embrace Christ and that this duty might be your delight? If Christ cannot allure us to give our hearts away to him in a manner, he will force us to give our hearts to him. I confess it is sad to slight and disobey the voice of the rod. God has two times fearfully shaken the threatening rod of his wrath over the city of Glasgow in a few years. Look that so many menacings of God's rods be not the forerunner of some sad stroke from the Lord. Now this is your duty, to be hearkening to his voice. This is Christ's first word and his last word, and it is his best word. Oh, then take him and embrace him. I think there be seven steps of judgment which are like to overtake us if we hearken not to his voice. I say God has spoken much, and what can he speak more? And what can he do more? And what can he do less to him? I say all the slightings of the threatenings of God to you are the forerunners of the seven remarkable steps of judgment. The first step of judgment, which ordinarily does befall slighters and disobeyers of God's voice, is God shall slight their voice when they cry unto him. And oh, is it any wonder that God stopped his ears at all our prayers, because it is known that we stop our ears to his precious invitation and cry which Christ hath to us, "O, take me." Therefore I say, O, give Christ your hearts, and then he will hear your voice. There is a second step of judgment which ordinarily befalls those who slight these great and precious voices by which he is speaking to us, and it is this: be afraid that at last you come not to this, that you shall have no answer from God, that God shall speak no more to you. Yea, that you come not to this, that God shall speak his last words to you and have no more to say. I confess when God goes from preachings to rods is an evidence that we are hard to be persuaded. It is said when he makes the rods our teachers that he will not be taught by them, though I think that that were a blessed cross that should make us come to Christ. I think Christ must do to us as Absalom did to Joab. He sent to Joab to come to him, and he came not. Absalom then set his cornfields on fire so that at last he might come. So I think Christ sets our cornfields on fire that we may be constrained to come to him. There is a third step of our judgment, and it is this. I fear that sad and lamentable word is like to befall us if we continue to slight this gospel. Ezekiel 21:5. That all flesh may know that I, the Lord, have drawn forth my sword out of its sheath. It shall not return any more. Yea, God has begun to draw the sword of his justice out of its sheath, and who knows when he will put it up again? Is there any person who has confidence or persuasion that God will quickly sheathe the sword which he has drawn against us? The fourth step of judgment, which lights down upon those that slight the voice of God's threatening rod, is that which I think is more sad, Ezekiel 21:11-12. The sword is sharpened and furbished that it may glitter, and that it may make a sore slaughter, that it may be given into the hand of the slayer. And what know ye but your disobedience to all these voices by which God has been speaking to you has made him to draw his sword, which he is to deliver into the hand of the slayer. And oh, who shall be the slayer into whose hand the sword shall be delivered? There is this fifthly, which shall be a step of our judgment if we continue to slight all these voices by which God does speak to us. And it is that word in Ezekiel 20:31, As I live, saith the Lord, I will not be inquired of by you. I will cease now to have correspondence with you any more. There is this sixth step of judgment which may and shall befall us if we go thus on and slight all the voices of the Lord to us. And it is that word in Ezekiel 24:13, I would have purged thee, and thou wouldst not be purged. Thou shalt not be purged any more till my fury, and so on. There is this last step of our judgment, which I think is the copestone of all the rest, if we continue in our slightings of all the voices by which God speaks to us. By all appearance there shall be one of these two decrees passed in heaven against us. First, either that in Hosea 4:17, Ephraim is joined to his idols, let him alone. Or secondly, that decree in Revelation 22:11, he that is unjust, let him be unjust still. And he that is filthy, let him be filthy still, and so on. I say today, if ye will hear his voice, harden not your hearts, as in the day of propagation. Glasgow is yet within speaking terms with God. Oh, who knows how long it shall be so. Now, if you will not hear him in the still voice of the gospel, oh, will you hear him especially in the whirlwind? There is nothing that will befall us which will be the copestone of our misery so much as that when Christ shall come and take his farewell. I think there are few of us who are here who are within the sight of Christ, but I am sure there are many here who are within speaking terms to Christ. Now what doth he require and call for at your hands? Do not all the promises and the covenant say, O come and take him? Do not all the rods and sad dispensations which we meet with say, O come and take him? Do not all the threatenings in the law say unto you, O come and take him? And do not all your convictions of conscience whereby your need of Christ is discovered say this unto you, O come and take him? Are ye not surrounded about with many voices that cry out this unto the city, O come and take him? Therefore, O harden not your hearts to this pleasant voice. I have only these seven words to speak to you, and I shall close. First, God has a threefold rod whereby he makes himself known to a people. He has a rod of his mouth whereby he makes known his word to us. There is a rod of his hand, and that is affliction and crosses. There is the iron rod of destruction when God doth utterly destroy. That destruction shall not rise up the second time. Now God has been long speaking to you by the rod of his mouth, and by the rod of his afflictions and crosses. And oh, now beware lest he come and speak to you by the iron rod of destruction. Look that the treaty which is betwixt Christ and you be not broken. Oh, be persuaded to lay hold upon your time while it is with you. Secondly, I would say this word to you. I think the slighting of the sad and lamentable threatenings of God, which he has threatened and denounced against you, is a sad forerunner of some sad strokes from the Lord. Are there not many persons who slight threatenings through the want of faith? They believe not that such a threatening is true, and therefore I think it is like that God will preach to your senses before you believe what he now preaches to your ear. I say the day is coming that before the threatenings of God be believed by some of you, he must preach to your sense and make you to feel that which you would not believe. And are there not many that will not make use of the threatenings because they believe the threatenings are not to them? And therefore they make not particular application of the threatenings to themselves. I confess I think it were good for every one of us to take home the threatenings to our own bosom. Thirdly, some will not take and make use of the threatenings because they mistake what is their meaning. There are some that let Christ threaten them what he will, and they are still in the dark, and cry out, "Oh, what does Christ mean by his threatenings?" This is clear from the practice of the Jews, John 7:33 and 34, compared with the 35th and 36th verses, where Christ threatens them with this, "Yea, a little while I am with you, and then I go unto him that sent me. You shall seek me and shall not find me, and where I am, thither you cannot come." Now what hinders them to make application of the threatening? It is in verses 35 and 36. "What manner of saying is this that he says, ye shall seek me and shall not find me, and where I am, thither you cannot come? Will he go to the dispersed among the Gentiles and teach the Gentiles?" So that they knew not the meaning of the threatening, and that hindered them to apply it. The fourth reason why many persons make not application of the threatenings is this, ignorance of their own condition. Some persons will be living under such a sin, and yet when that sin is threatened, they will not apply it because they know not their sin. Are there not some persons that will not take with threatenings for their worldly mindedness because they call their worldly mindedness frugality? Are there not some persons who, when a minister threatens against presumption, will not take with it because they think their presumption, faith, and confidence? And are there not many things threatened against hypocrisy and few of them apply? And this is because we think our hypocrisy sincerity. Fifthly, this mars the application of threatenings to many because God has a mind to destroy them. Therefore, they do not apply threatenings. That is a terrible word which is spoken of the sons of Eli in 2 Samuel 2:25. "Notwithstanding, they hearken not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them. Some God hath a mind to destroy, and therefore they do not apply threatenings." There is this sixth ground why persons will not make application of threatenings, and it is because ordinarily some persons are possessed with high thoughts of themselves, and too much of self-love. There is nothing mars the application of threatening so much as self-love. We have no will to believe any sad things against ourselves. Lastly, there is this which mars the application of threatenings, and it is our not knowing what a sad and sinful thing it is to slight and not apply threatenings. I confess, I think it is a question that is hard to determine, whether the slighting of promises or the slighting of commands or the slighting of threatenings be the greatest sin. But I am sure of this, our slighting of threatenings is a rise of our slighting of promises and likewise a rise of our slighting of commands. Now I shall say no more. Oh, that you were persuaded to hearken to God, that Christ might not be provoked to depart from you and take his farewell. And to him who is able to keep you, to hold him, till the breaking of the day, we desire to give praise. God's Threatening Rod by Andrew Gray. Taken from Micah 6, verse 9.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan hard drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan hard drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan hard drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan hard drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan hard drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.